third case of the day. The United States versus Robert Harris et al. Okay. Is it Mr. Orr or Ms. Orr? Excuse me.
This court. Hello, my name is Dana Orr. I represent the defendant Robert M. Harris on today's consolidated appeal. The sole issue for review with respect to Mr. Harris is whether Judge Gilbert understood his authority to depart from the advisory federal sentencing guideline range when sentencing Mr. Harris for conviction of, based on his conviction for conspiracy to possess and distribute crack cocaine in excess of 50 grams. Mr. Harris was sentenced, according to the guideline range of 235 to 293 months, based on his the amounts attributed to him by his co-conspirators resulted in a high base offense level, and his criminal history category was only one, having zero criminal history points. At the sentencing, which was held on January 18, 2008, the government actually recommended that Mr. Harris be sentenced to the minimum of the range based on his low-level involvement in the conspiracy, as well as his virtual absence of criminal history. The government further noted that 235 months was more than necessary to adequately punish Mr. Harris. In the same proceeding, Judge Gilbert noted that it was a shame that someone such as Mr. Harris would be going away for so long. Nothing in the sentencing transcript or the record reflects that Judge Gilbert understood his authority based on Kimbrough, which had been decided on December 10th, 07, to depart from that range in order to satisfy the factors for the objectives for sentencing under Section 3553A. Based on that, we would argue that Mr. Harris is entitled to a remand based on Kimbrough in order for Judge Gilbert to decide whether, if he had known of his authority, he would have further departed downward from his minimum sentence that he applied to Mr. Harris.
Okay.
Yes.
Want to reserve some time for further rebuttal?
Yes, please.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Orr. Ms. Kister.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning.
May it please the court, Mr. Leggins. My remarks will be very brief on behalf of Mr. Morrow. The sole issue presented this morning and the narrow issue is whether he received meaningful consideration of 3553 factors by the district court judge. And I would submit that there's an absence of a record, and from that we have to surmise that there was no consideration of those factors. There were several factors offered by the government. There were several factors offered in mitigation by Mr. Morrow's counsel. But all that the judge did was make a cursory reference to the pre-sentence report and a cursory reference to the statute, and he just called it by its number and said, here's the number I'm giving you. I'm imposing 504 months. Now, the sentencing range was 360 months to life, and this number, for all intents and purposes, was a number picked out of the air. I mean, we can't assume anything beyond that other than it was an arbitrary number. Perhaps it was substantiated by policy considerations, but we cannot know that from this record. And I would submit that Mr. Morrow received no consideration of any of the policy factors that he's entitled to under the statute.
Would you say, Ms. Kister, under our cases, that this is the sparsest, or have we allowed this kind of reference to 3553 to pass muster? What's your sense of our case law, and would we have to change it to arrive at where you'd like us to go on this?
It's certainly the sparsest record, Your Honor, in my experience. Judge Gilbert, and I've known him for years and respect him greatly, indicated on the record he'd had a bad day and he'd had a bad week. And I think what may happen is we all become inured to these drug cases. It's another drug case. Mr. Morrow is entitled to more than that. He's an individual. He's entitled to individual consideration. This is a man with diabetes. He's got a leg amputated. He indicated in the pre-sentence report he started selling drugs when he was 8 or 9 years old. And there certainly were. There was a story to this man. Judge Gilbert gave no consideration to any of those factors. He could have.
Were they brought up in the pre-sentence report?
They were in the pre-sentence report. They were those. His health problems were brought up by counsel at sentencing, and in all honesty, his own attorney didn't bring up a lot on his behalf. But those things were in the pre-sentence report. There was a lot in that pre-sentence report in mitigation of punishment.
Well, we got to presume that the judges read the pre-sentence report, and we have a veteran jurist, as you alluded to. But I appreciate your suggestion that it isn't as full of exposition as we might want.
And as you pointed out, counsel didn't highlight a compelling factor. I mean, the district court made it clear that he'd reviewed the pre-sentence report, and he also the computations and the factors set forth in 3553A.
That was all the judge indicated. And we know nothing beyond that. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Christian. Mr. Galloway?
Thank you. Good morning. My name is Gabe Galloway. I represent Damian James in this matter. There are several issues I raised. I want to start with the easy one. I think this is the same Kimbrough case that Harris has. I don't see any reason to distinguish them. The judge didn't say anything on the record. It wasn't discussed at sentencing, Kimbrough or Taylor, any of these issues. I've read the government's brief, and I think their response to the Kimbrough argument isn't very responsive. They say that the judge addressed the 3553A factors, and so somehow that means he understood his abilities under Kimbrough. I just don't think that's accurate or reflected.
Let me ask you this, though. In Mr. James' case, he was subject to the 240-month minimum on the conspiracy count, which is above the sentencing range for the distribution count of 188 to 235. And, in fact, he even went past 240. But my question is, how was your client affected by the 100-to-1 crack cocaine to powder cocaine ratio, since he had a 240-month minimum, which was above the distribution sentencing range?
He had a 240-month minimum on which count?
On the conspiracy count.
Okay. I appreciate your question, and I don't really have much for you.
That's all right.
Could you remind me how much he was up against on the distribution count?
The distribution count carried a sentencing range of 188 to 235.
Let's see. Well, could I proceed to the other arguments
sure,
that are even
certainly
more difficult?
But let me get back to this.
Okay.
The district court never mentioned one way or another the crack powder disparity, right?
That's right. Nobody did at the sentencing hearing. I'd like to move along to the speedy trial argument. The government has cited case law that is good law. It says that every time a new co-defendant is added, the speedy trial clock is reset. I can't quarrel with this court's decisions on that. I would like to give a quick policy argument. I don't see how the purposes of the Speedy Trial Act are served when the clock can be continually reset, potentially an infinite amount of times, every time another co-conspirator is brought into a case. These conspiracy cases can have an infinite amount of marginally involved people that can be charged in them, and it seems like the Speedy Trial Act is completely defeated if that can happen.
When we say reset, does that, in your mind, mean we ignore it then? It's excluded?
Well, that's what the judge did here.
Okay. Do you agree with that or disagree? that that's the law?
The way I read the cases that the government cited, this court has said that every time a new co-defendant is brought into a case, speedy trial clock is reset.
Does that mean it starts from day one again? Is that what your understanding?
That was my understanding.
Thank you.
Is my time up?
It is, but if you have a concluding remark, you may proceed.
I would like to quickly address the conspiracy argument very briefly. The facts in this case are mainly that Damian James delivered drugs to third parties, not supporting the idea that he was involved with the co-defendants. There's testimony that he was hanging out at their house. There was testimony that they rode in a car to Memphis. But there isn't testimony that supports the idea that they had a business relationship together to sell drugs.
Yeah, but he depended on others to get him the drugs. He pulled money with others to buy the crack, and then he tried to recruit people to join the team.
I understand. And I think the testimony about pooling money is the most damaging testimony here. But it's still not the kind of testimony that I expect to see in a conspiracy case where you're saying people have an ongoing business relationship to deliver crack. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Gallen. Mr. Leggins.
Good morning, Your Honors. With regard to Defendant Harris's argument, I don't know if you would call it a concession, but I did point out in my brief that this court has established case law that has said that a defendant who is eligible for the two-level crack reduction, the district judge should let this court know at that time whether or not he would be imposed or inclined to impose the Kimbrough case. So I would suggest that that's what this court should do with Mr. Harris.
And with respect to the other two, I mean, there's no mention of the crack powder disparity mentioned by anybody. Why shouldn't the other two go back as well?
Mr. Morrow shouldn't go back because his relevant conduct was in excess of 4.5 kilograms, which means he's not eligible for the two-level reduction.
So it wouldn't have made any difference.
It wouldn't have made any difference. With regard to Mr. James, as has been already pointed out, he was subject to a 240-month sentence, a mandatory 20-year minimum. So he wouldn't get the benefit of it either.
I just wanted to have the record clear. That was my understanding as well.
Okay.
There was a little confusion by counsel on it.
It is. It's implicit, I think. That's the reason it wasn't brought up below. But with regard to Mr. Morrow's argument about the scarce record on the statement of reasons, I agree that it is a very scant record, particularly for this judge. The way he ordinarily goes about his sentencing is demonstrated in James and Harris's sentencing. And in response to Judge Flom's question, I think about the case that is the most scant in this circuit is the Dean case. That's the case we cite. With regard to Mr. James's arguments.
And so in terms of Mr. Morrow, though, then do you think that given how scant this should go back to?
I
know you've relied on Dean, but I mean looking at the fact that it's 504 months given what his medical situation is, given his age and all these other factors.
I think this court should have more pause if the court had sentenced him to the low end of his guideline range. I think the fact that the district court thought that because of this defendant's background, his criminal history, his characteristics, that it was going to sentence him to it's almost 150 months above the low end of his guideline range. I think that militates in favor of not sending it back.
How old is this defendant?
I'm not sure how old he is. I wasn't the counsel below.
I thought I was going to say 35. Counsel, I see you're whispering to me 33.
I can't dispute that.
Close. Yeah.
With regard to Defendant James's arguments, as we've already discussed, Kimbrough wouldn't apply to him because he's subject to a 20-year mandatory minimum. I believe, despite counsel's policy concerns, the law is clear in this circuit on the speedy trial issue. And as Judge Williams pointed out, on the sufficiency of the evidence on the conspiracy, there was all of the traditional things that this court has said are sufficient to support a conspiracy. They depended on each other. They pulled their money. They recruited others. And there was a long-term dealing between them. So if there are no further questions from this court, I will yield the rest of my time.
Thank you, Mr. Liggins. Ms. Orr.
Based on Mr. Liggins' concession, I think, as you called it, I have nothing in rebuttal.
You don't want to persuade us otherwise.
No.
Take the money and run, right?
Right.
All right. Thank you. Ms. Kister.
Nothing else, Your Honor.
All right. Mr. Galloway. All right. Well, first of all, thanks to all Councilmen Liggins. As always, it's good to see you in court. And to our three appointed counsel, an additional thanks on behalf of the court for accepting these appointments and ably representing the appellants in this case. The case is taken under advisement.